So hi everybody, welcome to the people who've come along to this class. As Madonna has said, we're covering mind and its potential. It's the very first class in the BB teachings. Also welcome to those online. Let's begin as we normally do. You need to get comfortable in your seat. This just means that your feet are flat on the floor, your back is straight, your shoulders are relaxed, and you place your hands wherever you like. You can keep your eyes open or you can close them, whatever suits you. So we're going to do, right now, we're going to set our motivation for doing the teachings. I'll set up a visualization. You just follow along as best you can. As the explanation goes on, the slides will change up there. The words will be up on the screen. So if you want to follow along, please do. Okay, so get comfortable. Make your shoulders relax. Try to make sure that your head is sitting evenly upon your neck. And just let your body breathe itself. And feeling the body breathe itself, relax into awareness. And from the relaxed state of awareness, imagine that the nature of the ground beneath your feet is starry sapphire light, and it is as soft and light as a cloud. And the space above you is filled with rainbows and offerings. And directly in the space in front of you, on a throne, with a cushion of lotus, sun and moon, sits Buddha Shakyamuni. The Buddha Shakyamuni is surrounded by the assembly of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, deities and other enlightened beings. And you, on your seat, are surrounded by all sentient beings. These include your parents, other family members, friends, strangers and people you have great difficulties with, misunderstandings. While you're surrounded by all these people and with the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas in the space above you, recollect how fortunate you are to still be alive and to have the leisure and opportunity to attain a spiritual goal. Although you have the opportunity to attain a spiritual goal, you have to act quickly because things are not quite right. And this world does not exist as it seems to. Nevertheless, you do have a spiritual friend who is leading you in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So now to make your offering of practice as purely as possible, imagine yourself to be as clear as a deity. You're holding a vajra and bell, and you are within a sphere of great bliss. And from within that sphere of great bliss, you say, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So in response to this aspiration, From the heart of each enlightened being above you, lights and nectars stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. And the lights and nectars purify negative karma and obstructions. They increase your health and lifespan. And they increase your virtues and Dharma realizations. So cleansed by wisdom and bliss, recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. And then decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings into these four states. Then join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And in response to this aspiration, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down. And these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. Negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and lifespan are increased. And your virtues and Dharma realizations increase also. So cleanse by wisdom and bliss, relax. And from that relaxed state of awareness, invite the field for accumulating merit shall appear. And in front of the field of merit, you say, reverently I prostrate with my body's teaching mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, excellent and imagined. I declare all of my negative actions accumulated since the beginning of time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and other spirits to the great enlightenment. So we've purified our body, speech, and mind somewhat, and we've accumulated some merit. And we do not want to cling to these as being truly existent. So imagine that our body, speech, and mind, all of our virtues, all of our enjoyments are utterly transformed into a pure land, which we're going to offer to the Buddha, who is also the Lama indivisible. We say, this ground, anointed with perfumes, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings endure this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamriyatayaramu. So I've released the offering, and the offering has been accepted by the Buddha. He looks down at us. We look up into the eyes of the Buddha. And there we see immense humility, deep wisdom, kindness, and acceptance. Under the gaze of the Buddha, recollect our renunciation. Bodhicitta, and the correct view. Now from the heart of Buddha Shakyamuni, infinite light rays emanate, reaching all environments and all beings. And everything dissolves into light, which dissolves into the Buddha. He diminishes in size, moves through space, and enters the crown of your head, descending down to your heart. The bare face of your innate mind, with the covering of the perception of true existence and perceiving it as true, vanishes. Your mind and the mind of the Buddha become of one nature. You hear the mantra of the Buddha, and you begin to recite the mantra. Tayata Om Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha. Tayata Om Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha. Tayata Om Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha. And from your heart, rays of light fill the 10 directions of space. And every sentient being abiding within space is utterly transformed. From this perspective, every being is a fully enlightened being. This has come about through your efforts. And so the two purposes have been achieved. Your own enlightenment and your wish to establish others in the very same state. Rejoice in that. And breathe in through your nostrils. And then exhale. And at the end of the exhalation, just let your eyes flutter open. Okay, again, so this is the preliminaries to the classes, and welcome again, once again. So this course will take 10 weeks. We'll have 8 actual classes, then there'll be a review of the 8 classes, and then there's a game called Afflictions to Perfections, which helps us understand the material in a sort of more lighter way. Now, the topics that we'll be covering in this unit involve discussing, identifying and appreciating the human rebirth and deciding whether it's fortunate or not. We're going to look at different types of mind and the nature of the mind. And finally, we'll be looking at afflictions and their antidotes. There'll be other material too, but it's not as people to hold on to for the moment. The books I'm relying upon for tonight's presentation are a book here by Lama Zopa Rinpoche called The Perfect Human Rebirth. And the other three books are primarily to do with the nature of the mind, types of mind, and so forth. So there we have Samsara Nirvana and Buddha Nature by the Dalai Lama and Thupten Chodron. And the same authors have also written a book called Vajrayana and the Culmination of the Path. In the middle, we have Science and Philosophy in the Indian Buddhist Classics. This is volume 2, and it just deals with the mind. Now, every other book is much easier to read than that middle book. That middle book's like a scientific treatise, like from university level. It's good English, you'll understand it, it's just dense. And you'll need to sort of pause after every second sentence to think about what was said. Now, the material of these books, I've relied upon them to help me answer three questions that I'll respond to tonight. The first is human rebirth fortunate? That's the first thing we'll talk about. Then, are mind and brain the same? And finally, is it possible to eliminate the emotional afflictions we experience? That's what we're looking at tonight. Again, mind is potential today. Is human rebirth fortunate? Are mind and brain the same? And is it possible to eliminate? So let's have a look at the first question. Is human rebirth fortunate? Now, I've read where when this teaching was given in China, one of the students said, "That's impossible. There are so many humans here. What's so fortunate about being a human, living in China?" The thing is, there are a lot of humans, but there are less of them than insects and animals. The question we're asking is it fortunate to be human? Well, that depends. All right, so we're going to answer what the fortune is and what it depends upon. Is what we'll do first. So four reasons for fortune. The first off is it says it's very rare to be born as a human being with the leisure and opportunity to engage in a spiritual path. Now, not only is it very rare to have that leisure, the leisure to engage in your spiritual path depends upon a number of other conditions. In fact, quite a lot of them. And we'll be looking at these in the next couple of slides. So the first thing is it's very rare to be born as a human being and to have the leisure and opportunity to engage in a path. If you have, that's you're fortunate. Many humans don't have that leisure and opportunity. The second is that it has this great capacity for virtue that no other living being has. For instance, there isn't any other being that I know of that can develop and cultivate the mind of enlightenment. So humans can do that. Humans can decide to put an end to their suffering. They can decide to become good people. There's lots of things we can decide. And these decisions are also based around virtue. The third reasons for a fortune is to have, like I said, the freedom and the resources. The next two slides will be looking at the resources. So now just to be a human doesn't mean you're going to be happy, does it? I mean, so the resources we need are food, shelter, someone to love us, medicine. There's lots of them. Right? And we know there's lots of people that don't have those resources. Right? So if you have them, you are fortunate. The last is that the potential for ultimate happiness abides in the human being. So it's from the state of being a human being with this body and this mind that can allow you to achieve the omniscient state of Buddhahood in this very life. There's no other creature that can do So this seems to be the ultimate state of happiness, where you've accomplished everything you've desired, and now you have the pot, now you can actually help others do the same. That seems to be the highest goal in Buddhism. There are two other goals that are very worthy of our striving for and accomplishment. One is called personal liberation, where you put an end to the causes that cause you personal distress. You can do that as a human being. And finally, you have the potential to accomplish another rebirth, just like this one, where you can continue your spiritual path. But these are the sort of general fortunes we have as being a human being. Now, there's a way they describe them in the text, and that's where they talk about the 10 fortunes of being a human being. So five are personal and five are societal. So we'll look at those next. And these 10 are summed up in this quote. Now, it might be a little bit difficult to read it up because of the way it's been written. So I'll give you a few moments to read it and then I'll say it out loud.
Just read it out. It's okay.
Yeah.
It's big enough.
So first off, and this comes from Arya Sangha from his text, The Grounds of Hearers. He says, born human, in a central land with complete sense faculties. Not having committed the extreme actions, faith in the objects. When Buddha has appeared and taught the Dharma remains and is followed, and people have love for each other. So if you run into these conditions, you are extremely fortunate, and you seem to be a human being with great fortune. So let's have a look first at the first five fortunes of a personal individual to yourself, right? First is that you're a human being. Being a human being, you have the intelligence of a human. This is a major import when you consider your intelligence against any animal's intelligence. None of those animals could probably read a book or know how to develop a mind of enlightenment or renunciation or really cultivate virtue. It's very, very difficult. But here, it's easy as a human. So you have the intelligence of a human being. You find yourself living in a land. This land is called Australia, of course, Brisbane in particular. But Buddhism is thriving here. So we are in the region where the Dharma was taught. As you know, this is not common. You have a healthy body and mind. If you have this, this is great fortune. There are many, many people that don't. And there's others who ruin their body and mind, the health of their body and mind. We so far haven't. Now, you've not committed any of the five actions of immediate retribution. So these five actions of immediate retribution are to kill your mother, to kill your father, to make an attempt to kill the Buddha by you bloody them, to
kill an
arahat, and to create a schism amongst the religious community or the Sangha. So these seem to be really bad acts and to have an immediate retributive quality in some of the texts. But if you haven't done that, hey, you're doing really well. So you look at this and say, well, does that apply to me? Because if it does, if these five, if you've met the five or any of them, you could say, well, I have the five fortunes. So, one more. Have and belief in things worthy of respect. Now, these things could be karma, the teachings of the Buddha, the ability to rely upon a spiritual teacher, the humility to do so, these sort of things. So if we have these, we've got the first these five here. Then there are five that are provided by society. First is that a Buddha is present in the world. The second is the Buddha is teaching the Dharma. Third is the teachings are flourishing. Fourth is that mentors, monastic, and like-minded people practice. And there are benefactors who offer the four requisites for life. So these requisites are usually food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. What you often find is that the benefactors of our society offer money. They offer and shelter, robes, that sort of thing takes place. In our community, there are mentors, there are monastics, and there are like-minded people practicing. The teachings are flourishing. Now, these two last ones, a Buddha is teaching the Dharma and a Buddha is present in the world. This is all of these two conditions are not strictly fulfilled now. There are presently qualified spiritual mentors who give the teachings of the Buddha. And this suffices for fulfilling these two conditions. And many of you know, if you've taken refuge and you're engaged in tantric practice, you see your teacher as the Buddha. And if it's a little bit back, you see them to be like the Buddha. And of course, our teacher's always teaching the Dharma and instructing the Buddha talk. So here we have the 10 fortunes. Now, what do these fortunes enable for us? What's the benefit of having them? First of all, you have this ability to achieve the realm of gods or humans, which means at the time of death, you can either once again be reborn as a human, and with a great possibility of having leisure and opportunity and those 10 conditions in place. There are also realms that they call the realms of the gods. Now, these realms are achieved through we ourselves developing really stable states of concentration. That's possible if you wanted to do that. But really, what's even deeper impact, it allows us to free ourselves from the disturbing emotions. That's what we can do as a human. It's a leisure opportunity and it's great fortune. It can even allow us to attain Buddhahood itself. So there's a text called A Letter to a Friend by a great philosopher and great practitioner called Arya Nagarjuna. So in this text, he says, look, if you find yourself in all these conditions, you have leisure and fortune, and you want to engage in the practice, and you can do, yet you don't. You do something else, right? This is what he says about it. More stupid yet than one who throws some slops into a golden vessel all bejeweled is one who's gained a precious human rebirth and wastes it in an evil, sinful life. Now, I first heard this verse and its explanation given by a great teacher called Kensei Kishitoshi Sero at our old center. So when he said it, I really got rocked, you know, because I thought, I looked and I went, oh my body is the golden vessel, my eyes, all my senses are the jewels. So I have all this, right? And yet what I'm doing is I'm imbibing crap through my senses and filling my vessel with it. That's how stupid I am. And I thought, yeah, I am. That's what I've been doing for the last 40 years. But no doubt about it. And then I go, yeah, I've been wasting it. I have been. And so I thought, wow, this really describes me. But you know, like you say, you can always stop it. You don't have to keep doing it. I mean, once you realize, you go through those lists and go, yeah, I've got that, I've got that. Yes, I'm a human, I've got intelligence. And you're saying that there's other plenty of other people who have done this with it. And I could too. You know, so you just thought, okay, I've got to cut back on absorbing the
On
crap. Yeah, that's right. I've
Facebook.
got to get off Facebook. I've got to get off some of these media things, right? I have to stop that. Make a change. So, do you guys find anything interesting in what's happened? Are there any questions you'd like to ask? Did your mother kill your father, killed an Arahant, drew blood from the Buddha, or tried to kill the Buddha and drew blood, and then created a schism, a break in the religious community? Yeah. Now you can repair it. That's right. So you can do practices that take away the effect of it. And so you don't actually experience the effect. Yes, you put in place the cause, but now you weaken the cause's probability of creating its future effect. But if you don't do anything, the effect is absolutely terrible for you. But if you do something, it's not.
It's certainly a different paradigm because it's like in the media we just hear all the time, you know, we'll never be able to have a house, we'll never be able to have a career that lasts our lifetime. The planet's probably not going to be habitable for very much longer. So that's one paradigm of like all of this normal kind of lack. But then looking at this, it's just like a list of things we don't normally consider. Let alone that they're everything that we need.
Yeah, so until you come across it, you'd never think about your life like
In that
this.
way.
Yeah, that's
Yeah,
right.
we take all those things for granted,
Yeah,
don't we?
yeah,
Or that they're not that remarkable even.
There's a one, what I've found that this topic, this top, all these things come under the topic called fortunate human rebirth. And here we've just been really talking about the 10 fortunes or 10 conditions that provide your fortune. So one of the things that you should come away with that is a sense of pride in just being a human being who's alive today. If you have leisure opportunity and these 10 conditions, that you should have legitimate pride in being the person you are. It doesn't require any more than that because you have this great potential. There's many humans have done.
Right, and then there's so many more than that, the pretense, and then so many more scores of
Sure.
people that are in the hells.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, it's just like we're like the top of the pyramid,
yeah,
kind of a thing.
It's as if you've won a lottery that was impossible to win.
Yeah,
you got the first prize.
Yeah, and I mean, many. If you're undergoing homelessness or you don't have those, you know, enough food or shelter, you get really depressed and you feel like you're worthless because no one's showing care or worth to you. But you could be homeless, theoretically, recognize these things and not be depressed.
Yeah, that's true. The other thing is you can recognize that you might not have some of these conditions, and one of the advice was, get them. So I remember when I was in New Zealand, right, so the Dharma wasn't there at that time, and yet I had an interest in it. I couldn't find any. In fact, the year I left Lama Zopa, as Lama Yeshe arrived in New Zealand, I spent another 20 years here missing it again, right, until finally I found it here in Brisbane. So it's like, yeah, so the Buddha might have been here teaching, but I didn't have that condition, I missed it. You know, and then I found Langri Tangpa Centre, and then it's like, okay, now I've got them all. Okay, well, let's just do a meditation. So again, you just get comfortable in your seat, which basically means your back is straight, your shoulders are relaxed, your hands and feet are comfortable. So we're going to contemplate these 10 supportive factors, the 5 personal and the 5 societal, that make spiritual growth possible in this lifetime. And that's a very fortunate thing. So just allow your breath to naturally deepen. You become more aware of the breath, of your body breathing itself. Just release the day's concerns with each exhalation. Now set an intention to recognize the rare fortune of your current circumstances. Then sort of cultivate gratitude to transform these ordinary moments into a spiritual opportunity. Think, by having this life, you intend to achieve Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings. So remember that you, as a human being, possesses human intelligence. This intelligence is capable of ethical reasoning. You can decide and know what's right and what's wrong. You also have healthy faculties for learning. Your eyes are still working, your ears function. You have a workable brain. And you also have access to these teachings. Wisdom and compassion. These conditions are rarely found together. So, like a rare constellation where all planets align perfectly, a precious human birth requires multiple favorable conditions converging simultaneously for spiritual transformation. If you recognize that you have these conditions, this should awaken appreciation for each day's potential. You can prevent the waste of irreplaceable opportunities for your own inner development. So, what deeper significance lies in having both personal capacities and societal support for practice? This convergence between your own personal capacity and societal support creates an unprecedented potential for your own liberation that transcends individual effort. You have the support of all enlightened beings of the past and present, and you have the support of all sentient beings. So how often do you pause to recognize these converging conditions in your daily life? So most moments pass unnoticed, yet each contains the same precious potential. So tomorrow, remind yourself. Now, of all the conditions, which single one can you consciously appreciate and utilize tonight for spiritual growth? Choose one of the resources, then dedicate one action to meaningful development. And tomorrow, just try to recognize one precious condition. Do this in the morning and transform your routine awareness into a sense of spiritual gratitude. You have something very precious, something meaningful. And then carry this recognition forward, knowing that each moment offers the rare constellation of conditions supporting your own liberation from suffering or full enlightenment. And breathing in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale. And let your eyes start to open if they've been closed. So now we're going to look at the second part. And here we're asking, are mind and brain the same? Now, to find the answer like this, what we'd normally do is that we would resort to science, right? We rely on what science has to say about this. But at present, modern science has no means of detecting the presence or absence of consciousness. Yeah, physical phenomena. So the mind is not a physical phenomena. It's mental. Doesn't have any of the characteristics of physical phenomena, other than being impermanent. They're both subject to change. So science really struggles detecting consciousness beyond brain activity. They can do that, no problem. To say that that is consciousness, that's...
No, that's the sci-fi movies, isn't it? Where yeah. They go, here's this little packet of memory in your brain, but it's science fiction.
Yeah, it's fiction. Yeah. This is like trying to catch sunlight with a fishing net. Scientific instruments designed for physical matter cannot capture consciousness's subtle, non-material essence. So we've got these massive machines trying to detect consciousness and stuff, but like it says, all it can actually detect is physical phenomena. That's what they're set up to do. And then, of course, ideas come from the discoveries. So we come to this major question, and this answer is like, from a Buddhist perspective, they say definitely no. Mind and brain are not the same. They have different natures, according to Buddhist understanding. But one is made of matter, atoms, matter atomic. It's the brain. Mental phenomena are not atomic. They can't be measured. So this has made the major difference. Mind does not lead itself to quantitative measurement. The brain does. Anything physical does. But mental phenomena do not. You can't measure them. They have no color in themselves. They have no weight. They have no size. So the mind is the clear, cognizant awareness. In fact, you could just call it experience. That's mind. It's the cognizant awareness that experiences and knows objects, while the brain is the physical organ that supports mental processes in this life. So the mind serves as the fundamental basis of consciousness, while the brain acts as a physical support system. And there are divisions in the mind. So Buddhism distinguishes between gross mental processes, which are dependent on the brain. Many of our conceptions and ideas, our vision, our taste, all these phenomena that comes with consciousness, they are heavily dependent on the brain. There's no doubt about it. But the brain does not produce them. They're highly dependent, but it's not. As a metaphor or analogy, so the mind is like a rider who can mount different horses throughout a journey, while the brain is like one particular horse that serves only for this lifetime's travels. So I'm just going to pause here. There's more about this coming up later on in other units, but I just want to sort of bring it in pretty quickly, because we're talking about the mind. There's going to be these really basic questions we have about it. So from a Buddhist perspective, there's very good reasons for them to say they're not the same entity. And if you were to say they're the same entity, you've got a lot of problems. Now next slide, I'm going to say what's interesting. So this is where you can bring questions up. But I'll just ask this question myself, and I'll run it through artificial intelligence and said, okay, tell me what's interesting about this phenomenon. Right? So this is one of the things that came up. He said, it's the most important thing to remember. He says, Buddhist philosophy proposes that consciousness and physical phenomena arise through interdependent causation rather than one being reducible to the other. So the Buddhists don't say a mind will produce a brain, and they don't say brains produce minds. They're not going to say either of those things. They're both out. But they do have their causation is interdependent. Like, you're not going to have a brain if you don't have consciousness. And many forms of consciousness depend upon a brain, but there are others that don't, or depend very little upon the brain. So Buddhists have a presentation of mind being as a continuity, but of different types or levels. So we have this mind that I'm looking at you now, visual consciousness. It's called a gross mind. And even thinking is called gross. Conceptual seems as gross. Perceptual seems as gross, perceptual consciousnesses. But then, you know, when we go to sleep, right, we're not there, is there? There's a type of consciousness there. They call it dream consciousness, or the consciousness of deep sleep. And that's more subtle than visual consciousness. And, you know, even when you are knocked unconscious, like, consciousness is still there. It's not like you're dead. Like, it's still functioning, but at a much lower level. And then they say, even at the time of death, is a type of consciousness that is no longer dependent upon the brain and is still present. So there's different layers of it, but they're all continuities, different levels too. Now, the easiest thing about what's interesting is that the mind and the body work together and like a team rather than one controlling the other. Your thoughts affect your body, and your body affects your thoughts. They need each other to work properly. Buddhist philosophy sees them as connected rather than separate.
So what I find interesting is that you kind of figure out how they're connected by when body and mind don't work well together, when something goes wrong one way or the other, and that's where it becomes really apparent
Depend upon each other.
Yeah, how they depend upon each other and the workarounds that we have to do.
Another thing, this is the interdependence principle means that consciousness and matter co-arise through mutual dependence rather than existing separately. And that's one of the things we often think is it's been presented to us that way, right? They're either separate phenomena, and then you go, gee, there's going to be a problem now, aren't we? Because I've got a body and mind, and we know. But if they were completely separate, something could happen to my body, my mind would be fine, or something could happen to my mind, and my body would be fine. But that's not what happens, is it? So no, they can't be separate. And if they were the same, then you have to go, now we've got another problem, isn't it? Think of all the different mental phenomena. And say, so they've got the characteristics of something physical. Well, they don't. They can't be the same, and they can't be separate. And yet that's often been the way it's been presented to us growing up, isn't it? Doesn't seem to be another option. Now, here's a quote from the Buddha from a scripture called Luminous. And this is a way of leading us into the next topic. So he says here, difficult to read, he says, this mind, O monastics, is luminous. It is defiled by adventitious defilements. The uninstructed worldling does not understand this as it really is. Therefore, for him, there is no mental development. Then he says, this mind, O monastics, is luminous, and it is freed from adventitious defilements. The instructed Arya disciple understands this as it really is. Therefore, for him, there is mental development. So what's being mentioned here, this word luminous, is actually referring to the Buddha nature, even though there's no mention of Buddha nature in the Pali scriptures. But there's this word luminous. But this is the nature of the mind. It's luminous. Now, what it's showing here is that if you don't know the nature of the mind, it's very difficult to develop it. If you have the wrong understanding of how the mind exists, or you don't know how it exists, it's difficult to develop your mind fully. But if you do know, then major development can take place. And so here we've got two different people. One person doesn't know, called the worldling, the person of the world, and the other, the instructed Arya. So the Arya is a person who has actually been taught about the nature of the mind, and then he's used that to develop his mind and be called an Arya. So an Arya is a person who's seen the ultimate nature of their mind, the mind existing as it is. Others haven't. People like ourselves, for instance. Well, our understanding of the mind, or the way we see it, is conceptual. We've never seen it directly as it is, luminous. I might be wrong here, some of us might have done this.
Is that because it's covered in defilements?
Yes, the most major one being the conceptual defilements. Just our idea of how the mind exists prevents us seeing how it exists. And then, of course, this is if you see we have defilements or emotional afflictions and so forth. Right? It makes it very difficult then to get at the nature of the mind. There's a number of terms here. One is called adventitious defilements. So when the mind is defiled, you can't see the nature of it, its absolute nature. But these defilements are adventitious, meaning they come and they go. They're not always there. They depend upon conditions and causes. If you remove the causes and conditions for these defilements, they won't be there. Then you have access to the nature of the mind. Okay, so there are a number of different reasons to show you that this is possible. So this question is now we're asking the question, is it possible if we are born human, we're human beings, if we have the conditions in place and have an understanding that the mind is not the brain, it is an entity of clarity and knowing, then we have that already, then is it possible for us to put an end to our own problems which are created by the mind? Is it possible for us to put an end to problematic states of mind, awareness and so forth? So the Buddha say, yes, it is. Otherwise, I wouldn't have taught this stuff to you, right? And so the reasons are of threefold, and we'll look at them all together, and they're one at a time. So the first is, it's possible, we ask, is it possible to eliminate the delusions completely? And the answer is yes. And why? Because it says, first of all, the basis is pure. So we'll go through each of these. Then the second is that the afflictions are adventitious. Again, like adventitious means they come and they go. They can only come when the conditions support them. They can only stay while the conditions support them. And if the conditions aren't there, they can't be there. Right? They vanish, not there. So that's what we mean by adventitious. And we know this. Because, like, right now, if I was to say to you, do you feel really angry right now? I mean, really enraged. I'm sure each of you are going to go, like, no. And if I said, why not? What would you say?
Nothing here to be angry at.
That's right. That's exactly right. The conditions aren't here. So right now, we're not angry. That's it. So just like that. If the conditions aren't there, the mind can be at peace. That's good news, isn't it? Not only that, when they're not here, it doesn't mean to say we don't have any. It just means the adventure has not yet begun.
False sense of security there.
Yeah, that's right. So even though we might not be feeling powerful rage right now, we know we could do if we haven't trained our mind. Right? If the conditions come, yeah, I could get really angry. Yeah, it's also possible that just because it could be possible that the conditions are there and I'm not. That's also possible. But why? Because it's possible to cultivate powerful antidotes. There's somebody who could be doing something in this room that normally would inspire great rage within us. And yet when they read there, we would not feel that way. So this is the adventitious part. But if we knew that every Tuesday night or Wednesday night they come here and get us raging, we might think, oh, I don't want to come to these classes anymore, feel like that. I need to do something about it. So I can find out what are the antidotes to rage. I could practice those. That person could come in, they could carry on again, and you would be patient. You might even really appreciate them and have great compassion for them, understanding that their behavior is because they're really out of control. They're suffering so badly, they behave like this. That doesn't always require that we have rage when the conditions are there. It's when the mind is untrained, yeah. Everything doesn't naturally follow. If it's trained, then it's different. You train yourself, it's different. So the delusions only temporarily obscure the light of the mind, the clear light of the mind. It's always temporary. But if you apply the antidotes, they won't even come up. If the conditions aren't there, it doesn't come up. Let's look at the three reasons. First, look at the basis is pure. Basically, they're saying the true nature of the mind is pure. And you go like, why? This is because its nature is to be clear and knowing. So clear has a number of different meanings. One of them is just that it's a non-physical phenomena. One of the other is that it just has this reflective capacity. The other is, I guess you say, when you look for it, you can't find it. It doesn't objectively exist. So delusions such as anger, attachment, and ignorance are not part of the mind's essential nature. They are adventitious, meaning they arise due to causes and conditions that can be removed. So here I've got this example of the bottle of water. So one bottle on the left there you see is dark brownish, right? It's muddy. If you leave it alone, the mud will just go down to the bottom and the clear water arises again, just like in the second picture. You just leave it. You don't agitate it. You don't bring other conditions into it. It just returns to its natural nature. So you know, there's lots of practices in Buddhism where you do this, don't you? You just try to relax as much as possible, as much as possible. You keep aware, things come, they go. And after a while, they stop coming. And then the mind's clear nature reveals itself, like a clear mirror. As soon as you think, the mind takes on the nature of the thought object, right? The clarity disappears again. Wait for it, and relax, 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 and the clarity appears. It's just like this example here of the bottle of dirty water, and then, yeah, you wait a bit or you do something. You know. We could also filter the water, couldn't we? That'd be like an antidote. Like, oh, really dirty water, I need to put a filter on the top, pour it out, the dirt will get removed, and there's my nice clear water. You could do that too. So either way. So no matter how murky the water may be, its essential quality of clarity is always there. It's never lost. It doesn't go anywhere. Afflictions are adventitious. So again, like I said to you a minute ago, you know, rage is an affliction. It's afflictive, right? Drive you nuts. Right? Are you feeling that right now? You're going, no. So it's adventitious, you know? Sometimes our minds are peaceful and calm. That sort of means that we must be doing something, isn't it, to get ourselves so worked up. To cloud the mind, so to speak.
So those weather systems that roll in to the mind, the clouds and the turmoil, aren't they, they're not the mind, or they're not the ultimate nature of the mind? Or?
Well, no, they're not. They're just conventional nature of the mind. But you see, for that to take place, other things are required. And if those other things aren't there, then the mind just retains its natural nature. It's very possible to make sure those other things aren't there. The simplest way is to concentrate the mind. If you concentrate the mind on one object, those other objects can't appear. Your mind can only do one thing at a time. So if you rest on one object and keep it there through the power of concentration, the afflictions can't enter that. It cannot be disturbed. But as soon as you stop, of course, then they come. Then your conditions will have a go into it. So concentration is not enough. It requires wisdom, like trying to discover how do these afflictions actually exist? How am I misapprehending them? Like what am I doing to keep creating the turmoil? Can I find out what that is? Can I stop it? And from a Buddhist perspective and from the historical narrative of the Buddha, the answer is yes, of course. Now, so you have to remember this, the Buddha discovered this for himself 2,500 years ago. People are still doing this. If it didn't work, it should have stopped a long time ago. Someone who discovered a lot of them just refuted the whole lot, got all rubbish. But no one has. And like I said, there's got whole universities in India still practicing. People are really giving this a go. In fact, Alan Wallace is setting up a university in New Zealand. They've bought a heap of land out there, and they want people to do 3-year retreats, right? So they actually have the experience and go, yes, we want scientists to do it. Not just ordinary meditators, but scientists, so they can have the two ways to engage more meaningfully with the monastics, with the actual meditators. So as we know, sometimes our minds are peaceful and calm. We're not always afflicted. So right there, we know there's a potential for the mind to be that way, but it's this way right now. Now, thirdly, there are powerful antidotes against the afflictions. So one thing I think you should take some heart from is all the afflictions are based just on a wrong idea. They all come from a wrong conception. You destroy that wrong idea, all the delusions collapse. They're based on it. This is like pulling the ground out or pulling the chair out from someone, they fall over. Well, all delusions fall over when you pull out their root, which is ignorance. It's misapprehension. Now, this is a picture here, not so clear, But there's this Chinese fellow and he's holding onto a big cloth. And what that cloth is asbestos. And it's got dirt on it. It had dirt on it. So you know how they clean dirt off asbestos? Anybody?
Fire.
Yeah, they put it in the fire. Or you get a blowtorch, right? And you aim it at that thing. And what it will do is it will burn off all the dirt and does nothing to the cloth. Delusions are and afflictions are burnt away with the wisdom realizing their empty nature, realizing these things don't intrinsically exist. And the mind stays, it doesn't burn away the mind. It's just like, you know, space and clouds, right? Or smoke and space. You can blow the smoke away, but the space stays. But space doesn't go anywhere. It's the same with the mind. The mind stays right where it is. But the afflictions go. But why? Because you use an antidote. With the smoke, you force the air, you blow it out. With delusions, you find their opposites. So, for instance, if you find yourself as being a very angry person, and you decide, I need to do something about it. The antidote to anger is patience or forbearance and kindness. Loving kindness. You do either of those, anger can't stand in the face of it. Again, anger is a wrong consciousness. Loving kindness and forbearance are based on the reality. They're valid consciousnesses. So every delusion has an antidote. Again, so coming back to the beginning, so it's only as a human being that you have the power to do this. And dogs, animals, every insect, you can't do it.
Not even dolphins?
No, not even the dolphins.
But the thing is that a whole lot of animal communities can live together harmoniously and humans can't. They can't necessarily live together with other species of animals, but in amongst themselves. Animals have a lot more like social consciousness than... We have
capable as humans. Yeah, so Nagarjuna compares the mind to asbestos cloth that is filled with dirt. When put into fire, the dirt will burn, but not the cloth. Similarly, the fire of the wisdom, realizing emptiness, will destroy the defilements, but the clear light mind will remain unscathed. In fact, from a Buddhist perspective, there's no way you can get rid of a mind. Mind has no beginning, no end, and you can't find the middle when you look for it.
That's the middle.
That's right. So this is why we can actually put an end to the delusions. But it's not only that you can put an end to them. Once they're gone, you can actually transform the nature of the mind itself. This clear, knowing nature can actually be transformed. So it's like dishes, right? Before you put good food on, you clean them up. Then you serve the food. Same here. This is where you clean the mind, right? You get rid of all the afflictions and your wrong ideas. Okay, now what? You're going to go for Buddhahood, baby. That's what you're going to do. You go now. Right, I got the working basis. Great. So this mind will produce the body and mind of a Buddha. So often we don't think like that, you know, the mind will produce the body. Well, at the normal level, sutra, can't do it, you can't do it. It's impossible. We're not talking about the gross mind. We're talking about the very subtle mind here. The mind that goes from life to life to life that you've cleared up. That mind can become the body and mind of a Buddha. And that's what they've been doing for the last, 700-800 years. That's the practice of highest yoga tantra. Turn substance of the ordinary human being into the enlightened being. And this transformation process is possible because of the stable basis of the clear light mind, the very subtle mind. That's always present. It's always been clean, it's always been clear. And that the habituation to all the good qualities is possible, because that's all it takes for the mind, is it? Just have it, you habituate it to certain ideas and behaviors, and you start doing it. So good qualities of the mind can be built up slowly over time. And of course, wisdom always enhances qualities. They're not diminished. Good qualities are not diminished by reasoning and wisdom. Only the bad ones. The ones that can't stand up to reasoning and intelligence and wisdom, yeah, they collapse. And they're not taken on to Buddhahood. It's only the good qualities. So Arya Shantideva, a great bodhisattva, who wrote the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, this is what he says about this opportunity. Right? You find yourself as a human being, you have leisure and opportunity, you have the human intelligence, and you know that the delusions can be overcome, right? That they're adventitious, they're opponents, and so forth, and just the nature of the mind. So Arya Shantideva says, thus, having found this moment of reprieve, if I now fail to train myself in virtue, what greater folly could there ever be? How more could I betray myself? Again, I mean, this is sort of shocking in a way, but it's a good shock. I think it's a shock we need to have. So the reprieve is to be here as a human being with human intelligence in these conditions. That's the moment of reprieve, because we know death is going to come sooner or later. We're not going to stay like this. Our lives are going to come to an end. So until it does come to an end, if we don't train ourselves in getting rid of these afflictions, when it's possible to do so, and train ourselves in good qualities to make this life meaningful and useful and every other life meaningful and useful, then how well, stupid could I be? How much more can I betray myself? How much more can I let myself down? Well, sure, some of you must have had moments in your life where you could have done something and you didn't. And something happened, you go, oh man, I wish I did that. I knew it. I should have. I had the chance to. I didn't.
Just too shy to do the thing. And then it just plays on your mind for years.
That's right. That's right. You know, this sort of thing happens to us, isn't it? So in regards to Dharma, it's difficult to find yourself in a situation where these things can be accomplished, where a fortunate human rebirth could be accomplished, liberation or enlightenment. In fact, it's highly unusual if you think about it. You know, it's very difficult to meet a teacher that you can trust and you have confidence in, and that you're not too scared of. Right? So you can actually talk to them about this spiritual journey, about what your mind is doing, and get good advice from them. That's not an easy thing to accomplish. Shantideva says, if he fails to school himself in virtue, virtue is a cause for happiness. You know, you say, if I fail to school myself in the causes of future and present happiness, and accomplishes nothing good, and if under the influence of the eight worldly concerns, he consumes his entire life in distractions, he is deceiving himself. So, you know, the distractions have become more heavier and heavier, haven't they, in the last 5 years, right? Began with the mobile phones, we've got Facebook, we've got so much media, we've got all advertising hitting us. Every news program now, you don't just get the news, do you? You get something entertaining. There's a lot coming at us. And for most of us, we just take it in, think nothing of it. But here he's saying, look, if you keep doing that, like I said before, it's like being this golden vessel and just filling your mind with crap. Yet you have this great potential to do much more with it. You say, well, yeah, how much more can I deceive myself? I just did this instead. I just had a good time. You might say, you say, yeah, this life was a good life, but I've got nothing to take into the future lives. So is there anything you'd like to ask or say? Or
I was just thinking it would be so nice if the Buddhist teachings had the algorithm that like sucks you in, you know, the bottomless bowl, I can't get enough of it, kind of like, what's the algorithm to get you more interested in the Buddhist teachings than slops?
I think it's a great teacher. You meet an inspiring person, that's the one I think would do it. There's one thing, isn't it, to hear teachings like this, and you might go, yeah, okay, it sounds good, yep, okay. But until you meet somebody that actually embodies it, when you meet the person to the body, that's a different story. Right? Then you go, like everything I read in the head, this guy embodies it. I know he wasn't born that way. He tells me he wasn't born that way. I know he spent 50, 60 years developing this mind to be this person I admire in front of me. In fact, there's been a number of people throughout history that haven't practiced for 50, 60 years, have they? They've just got, they're really decent, good people. You know, it's just saying, yeah, you can train yourself to be one of those good, decent people, you know. What stops you being decent is your own afflictions. What makes you good is having a good, trained mind. Yeah, it is. That's right. And like they say, everything is in place already. The ability to become a Buddha already resides within us. It's just the natural nature of the mind. And there are other traditions from the Nyingma and Kagyu. And that's the whole big thing is just come to the nature of mind. If you know the nature of the mind, you're enlightened. You're a Buddha. Yeah. These are just different presentations. Others go, no, you need to develop, you know, and you need to have the body of a Buddha, so then that leads you into Tantra and so forth. But it's just, the major thing is to start at the beginning, right, to have faith that actually my mind is sort of good. I'm good. It's okay. The defilements are adventitious. I should not identify with them and say, yeah, I'm a bad person, or, you know, use negative words to describe myself. You shouldn't do that. Like I said before, if you just find yourself in this condition, you'd be great pride in just being a human being. Then not only that, but because of the nature of your mind, you know, I could become a Buddha. But, you know, so there are plenty of human beings on the planet, but not many of them know that. Not many of them know the nature of the mind. Most of it carried along with the materialism, right? Equating their brain with their mind, which is being pushed by material science.
Material.
Yeah, that's right.
Plenty it's a real dichotomy to sort of overcome.
But that's the thing, Ben. You know, so from a Buddhist perspective, they present three types of phenomena. They present material phenomena, everything physical, to quite, you know. Then there's mental phenomena, awareness. And then there are phenomena that are neither of those two. Yeah, so everything is not material. Like you talk about space, right? You could talk about time. You could talk about the past, present, and future. Are these phenomena material? No. You talk about area. You can talk about number. All these phenomena, they're real. They exist. But they're not physical material. And they're not mental. So there's another group. Yeah, so this side is very primitive, eh? You got to go
it's
like...
Divisive.
Yeah, but it's also very primitive and wrong. And you got to go, I'm not buying into that. Yeah. Okay, so is your love material? If you're not, it can't exist, can it? Can't exist. You don't love anybody. Nobody can love you either. Oh, my God. Yeah, that's the natural outcome of materialism, right? Yeah, it's a dead end.
Yeah, I'm not saying I agree with it now.
No, of course not. And I'm just saying, it's got some terrible outcomes in it. Okay, let's finish up. Let's do a meditation then. Eh? Again, just get comfortable in your seats. Let the body breathe itself. And as the body breathes itself, allow the body to relax. Just ease yourself into the present moment. From a state of awareness and presence, make a wish to benefit yourself and others.
Mm-hmm.
by opening the mind to the possibility of true freedom from the delusions. So the mind's deepest nature is pure. It's like the clear, open sky. It's like space. But this space, this clear sky, is untainted and luminous. The afflictions that disturb us, like anger, craving, confusion, doubt, anxiety, these are not fixed parts of who we are. They are temporary visitors. They arise from circumstance. With wisdom and practice, these delusions can be uprooted. And when they are uprooted, Buddha-like clarity within is revealed. So Buddha means knowing. So a knowing-like clarity is revealed. So like clouds covering the sun, delusions temporarily obscure the mind's light. But with the wind of wisdom, the sky becomes clear and bright again. So what evidence in your experience suggests that negative habits can weaken? No, so have you ever decreased any negative habit that you might have had? Perhaps you've noticed anger fade as understanding grows. Now, if you can accept that delusions are temporary, they come and they go, they're not always there. Would this shift your view of yourself? It's like, who are you if you are not your delusions? This should inspire some hope that change is possible. Now, when a negative state arises, could you recall an antidote, like patience or understanding, when anger arises, instead of reacting with that anger? If you knew of an antidote for a disturbing emotion, is it possible for you to be able to recall that antidote? I would suggest yes, it is. So it's with intentions that you practice the shift. So I'd like you just to remember the mind's pure basis, its natural freedom, and then using antidotes in daily life, stop problems from arising or manifesting. Accept that the mind's true nature is always pure, and that by applying your own wisdom, freedom is possible. And breathing in, exhale, let your eyes travel open. So our takeaway from this lesson is that you have a number of different reasons, four in particular, to support the belief in a fortunate human rebirth. If you ask yourself, do I have a fortunate human rebirth? Come up with four reasons for saying, yes, I do. This is why. Secondly, The mind and the brain are different. The brain can be measured, different quantities. Mind, no. The natures are different. One is physical, one is mental. One is atomic, one is not. And the delusions can be eliminated. They're adventitious and they don't stand up to wisdom. Like I said, every delusion is based on a faulty premise. So encourage yourself to keep trying. Okay, so we've come to the end of our class, and this is, if you're following online or if you would like to get the notes and things, on the LTC notes are online. Have a look at page 76, 77. There's a section there called Nature of Mind, pages 2 to 4. And if you have a look at the public exam questions 8 and 9, you'll see these questions, what we talked about, we answered them tonight. So next week, we'll look at consciousness itself. What's its nature? What's its function? What are its attributes and so forth? And then look at these different, what they call continuities of mind or continuities of consciousness. There are three: gross, subtle, and very subtle. So we'll talk about that next week. Thank you for attending and staying awake and putting effort into this. This is called effort or merit. So now we're going to dedicate the merit. So please join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. And a prayer for His Holiness's long life. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, for the quick discovery of Rinpoche's new incarnation. In holding and spreading the Moon's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you I make this request. Okay, so thank you once again for being here and engaging in the class, and thank you for those of you online.